It was born in Africa. Nurtured in the islands of the Caribbean. Developed and modernized in this country. And now, like the native returning, jazz is on its way back toward Africa. This is Biography in Rhythm, a special program of NBC News, tracing the history of some elements of present-day jazz to their origins in the primitive drum and chant syncopations of the Africans. Through field recordings, we'll take you to the Congo bush country to hear the free-moving rhythms of the native people. Then follow those rhythmic patterns as their influence was extended, first to the West Indies, then to the Americas. This is Arthur Wakely in the NBC newsroom in New York. And with me are two authorities on African rhythm and jazz, Arthur S. Alberts and Bill Brower. Mr. Alberts is widely known for his West African field recordings, the first high-fidelity recordings ever made of this native music on the scene. Until recently, American consul and public affairs officer in Leopoldville, Belgian Congo, Mr. Alberts followed up a wartime interest by returning to the area in 1949 and getting the traditional and contemporary music of the West African tribes on tape. From the original field recordings of Arthur Alberts, we'll go on to the modern phases of our story with Bill Brower, head of Riverside Records, a leading company in the recording of jazz and folk music, editor of The Record Changer, and jazz recording consultant to RCA Victor. Mr. Alberts and Mr. Grauer supplemented the former's African tapes by going to Cuba last April to record the African survivals there. For, as we've mentioned, the African influence was first extended to the Caribbean before being brought to this country. To start our biography in rhythm, let's go back to the beginning, the place where rhythm is the basic pattern of self-expression and, in a sense, of life itself. Jungle drums transport us to West Africa as we listen to a primitive form of rhythm drumming as recorded on the scene by Arthur Alberts. In contrast to the familiar American rhythmic meters that we know, one rhythm at a time, usually 4-4 or the three-quarter waltz time, this sounds complex and all mixed up with at least two rhythms going at once. But it's a standard African pattern, and here is Arthur Alberts to tell us about it.
We're starting off with an African kind of rhythm and blues, mainly rhythm and packed with fear and exhortation as an entire village of Baule tribesmen of the Ivory Coast turned out during an eclipse of the moon. The eclipse was clearly the work of evil spirits and a complete surprise to everyone, including my wife and myself. The chants and drum beats soon cleared up the moon trouble, and everything was happy, if not quiet, in Baule land. This song is a rare example of a vanishing primitive tribal music, impromptu in form and almost uninfluenced by the outside world. It also illustrates the primary distinguishing features of African music. Here, percussion dominates, produces complex rhythms by means of drums, rattles, and gongs, as well as hand clapping and an occasional empty whiskey bottle. Multiple meter is, of course, another important element. As the American musicologist Richard Waterman puts it, anyone who cares to perform a 6/8 beat with one hand, a 4/4 beat with the other, and a 3/4 tap with the toe of one foot will be convinced of the complexity of African multiple meter. A third musical feature is offbeat phrasing of melodic accents, or more simply, syncopation, a prime feature of jazz. Finally, the song leader's phrases and those of the chorus typically overlap each other. Overlapping call and response is heard everywhere, from the Baule bush to the Belgian Congo. Our Baule chant was an impromptu reaction to evil spirits. Now let's move along to a more formal type of African music. It's not that the Bambuli of the Eastern Congo who produce this music are formal people. We had flown east from Leopoldville one day on a modern Sabena airliner and landed in the heart of what was, before the Belgians, a main slave trading area. The Bambuli are still uninfluenced by the West, and their dance, in all its complexity of rattles and great wooden slit drums, is a ceremonial one, with the traditional musical elements handed down from father to son. The Bambuli are an unusual group, a whole tribe of sorcerers. This Bambuli dance demonstrates the magic powers of their secret drug, Masisi. At the height of the drumming, the leader, still dancing, thrusts a long, thin knife through both cheeks. Whatever Masisi may be, there are no apparent ill effects and no bleeding. This, therefore, is religious music in the pagan African sense. But there are other aspects of religion and music in Africa. For example, this one. That was one of the anomalies of Africa today. A pagan tribal drummer, one of several hundred pagan tribespeople who came to Brazzaville in French Equatorial Africa one night. The tribes gathered there to help celebrate the passage of a 3-ton altar stone from the old Catholic cathedral to the new church of St. Anne on the north bank of the Congo River. This, of course, was not religious music. Its fast, uninhibited beat merely marked a peak of pagan frenzy and goodwill toward the Christian mission in Africa. That, too, illustrates in a more direct way the African Negro's approach to religion by way of music and rhythm. The people are the Moshi, an important tribe of the northern Gold Coast and the French Upper Volta. The Moshi are largely Muslim, and this song was their rhythmic version of the Muezzin's call of the faithful to prayer. There is no God but Allah, and Muhammad is his prophet. In the Middle East and North Africa, throughout the Muslim world, the Muezzins call this from their minarets. And so, in Africa below the Sahara, the Moshi have popularized an essentially religious chant to express their urge to rhythm and dance. This, by the way, was a fine example of African overlapping call and response. It also offers an interesting parallel to certain Negro work songs of our own South. Now, here is something different, a sampling of a solo Congo drum. The Bakuba of the central Congo basin are noted for their drums and their drumming. This instrument was a decorated ceremonial drum more than 5 feet high. The drummer was a versatile musician of the old tradition. After lighting a fire under the drum to dry out the head and make it taut and hard, he produced his rhythms not merely with his hands. He tapped it with his fingertips, struck it with his wrists, and changed pace by using his elbows, all the while strapped to the heavy drum, which was as tall as himself. Now coming up is a unique example of African drum rhythms, a kind of drumming that few white men have ever witnessed. If some of that sound seemed to resemble splashing water, that's exactly what it was. This was African water music, not to be confused with a suite of the same name by George Frederick Handel. This music is uniquely of the Gabun area of French Equatorial Africa, the area in which Dr. Albert Schweitzer maintains his famous Bush Hospital. The rare character of this percussion is that it is produced without instruments. It is literally water music. Here in the Gabun, the women of a village dance hip-deep in a nearby pool. While dancing, virtually naked, they beat the water with their cupped hands, thereby producing the different rhythmic tones you hear. Of necessity, no water drum passage is a long one. The names of the women who produced these water drum rhythms sound very much like the high and low tones they made with their hands in the water. The women were called Woomba, Nzumba, and Lufuma, and also Maleka and Tambakana. More important, this Gabun water music perfectly illustrates something that Professor Melville J. Herskovitz, who heads the Department of Anthropology at Northwestern University, once said about African music. For the African, the important thing about rhythm is to have it, regardless of how it is produced. Stonecutters of Liberia, whose chisels sound like bells. Strangely enough, although this is a most primitive area, that bass effect, in the Gabun water drumming offers a parallel to the trombone of primitive jazz. And in another example of African music that is reminiscent of the modern, especially the modern so-called hot drummer, is this passage we recorded in the eastern Belgian Congo. That was a village of Congo pygmies recorded in the midst of a dance celebration. This kind of rhythm bears out the statement that the more primitive the African element is, the more complex are their rhythms. And the pygmies are the most primitive element in Africa below the Sahara.
Well, that seems to back up the theory we're presenting on where jazz started. And it's amazing how even the pygmies moved it along. Do you have any other points of proof on our theory?
I don't know if this will qualify as proof, Art, but let me repeat a story told by the authoritative American musicologist and composer, Henry Cowell. It seems that about 900 years back, the people of the city of Hejaz, in what is now Saudi Arabia, produced a unique kind of offbeat or syncopated music called jassir. And many of the Arab traders who fanned out across Africa, even as far as the Congo Basin, passed through Hejaz on their way. The old term jassir is still heard in parts of Africa today in reference to music. And jazz, as we know it here, became jazz, J-A-Z-Z, only in the early 1920s. Before that, especially in the New Orleans area, syncopated music was known as jazz, J-A-S-S. Jassir to Africa, to jazz, to jazz. It may not be conclusive, but it is interesting.
Now that we've been in West Africa via your recordings to sample the original influence, where do we go from here?
We follow the Africans. As a matter of fact, we follow the old slave routes from Africa because we're attempting to show that the drum and chant rhythms were transplanted to the West Indies and eventually to the Americas. In the 16th and 17th centuries, in fact, right up to the second half of the 19th century, the trade in slaves carried the African and naturally his rhythms to the islands of the Caribbean, notably Cuba. And our next jazz influences are, first, the African, and second, the mixture that's called Afro-Cuban. Was the African in Cuba. The music is a pure African transplant from Nigeria on the African West Coast via the Yoruba people called Lukumi in Cuba, who came there as slaves as late as 1870. Bill Grauer and I recorded this recently in the beautiful old colonial town of Trinidad de Cuba, over 400 years old. Columbus was there, so was Cortez on his way to take Mexico for the King of Spain. And Trinidad de Cuba has changed little since colonial times. As one of the chief slave ports of the Caribbean until well into the 1900s, Trinidad de Cuba gave natural protection to the older African religious practices and to the music associated with those practices. In this recording, note the call and response form, the complex rhythmic patterns, the blue notes. In this atmosphere, we recorded a story of African linguistic and cultural survivals in Cuba. Here is Bill Grauer getting that story on tape.
We're at the home of Senora Lydia Cabrera, probably the leading authority on Afro survivals in Cuba. And we'd like to talk to Senora Cabrera and find out a little more about her work.
Yes, I've been interested a long time ago in this matter.
May I ask how you first became interested in African survivals?
I think always because, you know, we always used to have Africans, I mean people from African descent in our homes, you know.
Your family has been in Cuba for many, many generations, haven't they?
Yes. And, you know, the life in Cuba was very close with the Negroes. They always became almost members of a family in a way, you know, as in the south of the United States.
Yes.
The same thing. So when I was a child, I always used to hear those tales, you know, of Paris. And afterwards, I went to Paris. And there I was studying Oriental things, religions and art. And one day I remember that looking at the Borobudur reliefs, you know, the temple, the Buddhist, I said, well, that's our Cuban mulatas. And then I began to discover how many analogies in the legends and in the magic, of course. Everywhere is the same.
We're very interested in the music of Africa and the music of Cuba. In the tribal rites, in the religious ceremonies, do you find that the music that is played today and is sung today by your Cuban Negroes is very similar or the same, or is it quite different from the music of Africa?
It's the same thing. Exactly the same thing.
It is exactly the same.
Yes.
Yes, many African rituals and ceremonies have survived, and the music sounds as it did in Africa. But having made that point, let's let Bill Grauer finish up the interview.
Most of these Negroes who sing this music and dance to this music are what generation?
Well, for instance, many of the grandfathers are Africans.
I might like to point out that we have in our presence, we're very honored to have a high priestess, a priestess of one of the Cuban tribes, Yoruban.
Yoruban.
Would you care to tell us the lady's name?
Well, her name in the religion is Echubi. It's one of the names of Elegua, the god of roads and, in a way, of destiny.
I wonder if you would be good enough to ask her when her parents or her grandparents or her ancestors first came to this country.
Certainly. Ellos quieren saber en qué año vinieron tus padres, tus abuelos, a Cuba.
Ah, no, yo no sé en el año.
Bueno, pero más o menos.
Pero más o menos, cuando ellos vinieron a Cuba, La Habana no tenía nada más que casa de mi abuela que vino a Cuba. Tenía la casa, la primera casa que le decía que es donde hoy le dicen Triconia, que ellos le decían la casa constituida, estaba en el puente de Agua Dulce.
She says that her mother told her that when her ancestors came to Cuba, there was only huts and not houses made in stone.
Yes.
So I suppose that it takes us to the first part of the 19th century, I suppose.
Mm-hmm. 150 years ago. There seem to be a great many rites, there are a great many survivals. Can you trace these directly to tribes in Africa?
Yes.
You can.
Certainly.
Would you care to tell us a little more about that?
Well,
where, for instance?
Well, for instance, we have from Nigeria. We call the Yorubas here Lukumi. Besides that, we have people from the Congo. We have here many Mbakas and many Bakongo. What is amazing is how this still lives in Cuba. And even they talk their language.
Oh, you mean the language has remained as it was in Africa?
Oh, yes.
I understand that you're doing a great deal of work in the language of the African peoples here, and that you are working on a vocabulary of several of the groups.
Yes, I'm making the Yoruban and the Congo. I'm taking it as it appears in Cuba.
I see.
And afterwards, perhaps I may go to Africa one day and...
Oh, you've never been there?
No, never.
Well, I think you probably are
going
there.
But in a little way, when you go to Matanzas and some places in Cuba, you are in Africa.
Was the drumming of Chori, one of the great drummers produced in Cuba from its African background. Chori plays on a weird assortment of improvised percussion instruments in the African tradition. He gives us a fine example of primitive African rhythmic survival mixed with latter-day Afro-Cuban rhythmic patterns. And there are others. Might be expected, Cuba has a wealth of drummers who are nurtured and developed in the old African rhythmic tradition. In addition to Chori, Cuba produced the late great Chano Pozo. And here is another great Afro-Cuban drummer, Manteca.
Exclusive artist of the Bamboo Club, Manteca!
This is the Havana nightclub setting for a part of our story of rhythm. Dancing is a national pastime in Cuba, and there, as elsewhere in the Caribbean, African rhythmic forms dominate the dance in all its varied forms. Rumba beat stems from the west coast of Africa, and the rumba is the best known of the Afro-Cuban dances. Traditionally, it is an exhibition dance, with the drums controlling the movements of the dancers. And that, too, goes back to the primitive dominant beat of the drum in Africa. And as the Afro-Cubans developed the original drum and chant pattern to a new rhythmic dimension, so did they develop new dance forms to suit their moods and temperaments. Mambo. It developed out of such Cuban dance lines as the rumba and the conga. And in keeping with their interest in new forms, when the Cubans had enough of the mambo, they had enough. A popular song called Goodbye Mambo this year rhythmically stated the fact that, in Cuba, the mambo is now as dead as the funny hug. Although the lyrics don't say so, the mambo has been replaced by something exciting and new, the cha-cha-cha.
With the rhythmic beat of Cuba's latest dance form variation, the cha-cha-cha, and one we predict will soon be very popular in this country, we close out part one of our story. Biography and rhythm will be continued after a 10-second pause for station identification. In the first part of our biography in rhythm, we covered the original, primitive African contribution to jazz, a contribution based on rhythms rather than melodies. Then we saw those drum and chant rhythms transplanted from West Africa to the islands of the Caribbean as the slaves carried their songs and dances with them, along with their forms of worship. For the original rhythmic influence was part pagan, part religious, in the antiphonal pattern of the call and response. Our story, like African rhythm itself, develops in a double-metered pattern.
The African has always been quick to adapt himself to his immediate environs. Early Negro slaves were no exception as they fused their own complex musical patterns with early American hymnal and marching band music.
Again, we hear from Bill Grauer.
They also brought from Africa the musical tradition of the work song. Remember the song of the stonecutters of Liberia, the call and response, as they strike their chisels in unison? Listen now to a group of prison laborers, a chain gang on a Mississippi road doing hard labor. Still slaves in effect, with chains on their legs and armed guards on patrol, they revert to their traditional work music, which, here though, is melancholy instead of joyous and free, as was the work music of the stonecutters, the music of free men. But the function and the form are still there, as it was in the early 19th century, when the slaves absorbed Christian religious music into their lives and enriched it with the warmth and fervor of their older pagan chants. Remember the Muezzin's call, the call to prayer in antiphonal form? Listen again as Africans worship.
La ilaha illallah.
La ilaha illallah.
La ilaha illallah.
La ilaha illallah.
Muhammadur Rasulallah.
The Muezzin calling his people. How little different is the sound of the southern Negro preacher exhorting his flock to walk in the paths of goodness.
Wash thy clothes. Feed up thy minds. Feed up thy wills. take away the shame.
Again, you have the call and response pattern, the syncopated rhythms so typical of the African musical patterns. Listen as the pace quickens, as the preacher becomes, in effect, an African witch doctor, as he harangues his people to do his bidding.
Amen. Glory to God. Hallelujah. May God's great name sanctify my father. You ought to be sanctified.
Here is a later and more sophisticated example of gospel, recorded in Washington by Reverend Kelsey and his congregation. The African heritage is still powerful, the survival is still strong, as Reverend Kelsey and his people work themselves into a frenzy with Little Boy.
Little boy group, tell the gospel, mother and father can't believe him on. They ain't enough to do with a man, that he turned a little boy but gone on.
Work songs, gospel singing. These two and one other were the repositories of the African musical and social heritage, which, with diverse other elements, were eventually to fuse into jazz. That one other important element was brass band music. Johnson Brass Band, a remarkably primitive group, was recorded in the Deep South. This is an extraordinary example of Africanisms in the earliest kind of Negro instrumental music. The slaves were forced to give up their big Congo drums early in the 19th century by the plantation owners, who felt that the rhythms were powerful enough to bolster the spirits of the people they wished to subjugate, so that with no tribal forms within which to express their great musical energies, the Negroes began to drift towards the European classical instruments, trumpets, trombones, bass horns, and reed instruments. The music they heard was the parade music of the brass band, and so they imitated it. In imitation, they naturally brought to the music their own concepts of rhythm, harmony, tonality, and form. As the years passed, they mastered these complex horns, and before long, there was heard in the South, and especially in New Orleans, the results of the amalgam of African music, slave adaptations, and European instrumentation and scoring. This first primitive jazz music was a swinging, marching brass band. Listen for a moment to a typical marching band with a beat. The Eureka Brass Band playing an old hymn, Sing On. Did you hear that marching beat at the start? And do you hear how they've begun to swing in a powerful but primitive early jazz form? Yes, Jazzia had indeed arrived in America. With the end of slavery and their gradual integration into Southern life as free men, the Southern Negro really began to express himself musically. Work songs became blues. Marching bands began playing the rags of the 90s. Church music became more and more rhythmic, and European musical forms of writing and harmony were being absorbed into this musical melting pot. The brass band as constituted in the late 19th century was too unwieldy for these musicians bursting with creativity. So they did the obvious. They reduced mass trumpets to one or two. They cut the trombone sections down to one horn. They threw out all the reeds except one clarinet. They added the rhythm section, and the classic jazz band had been formed. With these instruments, they played blues compositions, which were simply development of older work songs, and added the classical African ingredient, improvisation. Here is King Oliver's Creole Jazz Band in 1922 playing Dippermouth Blues. Listen to the band form, the trumpets playing the lead melody, the trombone filling in on the bottom, and the clarinet weaving lovely melodies on top. Yes, jazz music was on its way. From its start in New Orleans, jazz spread over the entire country, following the courses of rivers and the routes of railroads. It moved and it changed. When it went north to Chicago, up the Mississippi, it sounded something like this. The Chicago Rhythm Kings recording of Nobody's Sweetheart. When jazz hit Kansas City, Count Basie and dozens of other great Kansas City musicians changed jazz in other ways, and early swing music was heard. Here is the Basie band playing Clap Hands, Here Comes Charlie. Always change, always development, but always there remain the basic elements of its tradition. African intonation, African rhythms, syncopation, and above all, the freest African heritage of all, improvisation within the form. Tin Pan Alley seized upon jazz, and Paul Whiteman brought many jazz immortals into prominence. Here he is with Big Spiderbeck in the flapper-aged Mississippi Mud. King of the 30s, Benny Goodman. Here he is playing Sugarfoot Stomp. You will note that this is the same tune that King Oliver played earlier, Dippermouth Blues, but under a new title. Out of swing in Kansas City came the phenomenon known as bop. Yes, call it bop, call it swing, call it Dixie. It's all jazz. Here is one of the earliest bop classics. Dizzy Gillespie and Charlie Parker playing Groovin' High. Remember how we showed you how African music went into Cuba, how powerful an influence it had been in shaping the music of that island, and how powerfully its rhythms can be heard even today? Well, with the passage of almost half a century of change here and development there, jazz was beginning to lose sight of some of its basic heritage. The boppers seemed to sense this because they began to experiment with Afro-Cuban forms in their music. We told you earlier that there had been three great drummers in Cuba, Chory and Manteca, you heard them, and Chano Pozo, a remarkable rhythm talent who spoke more African dialect than he did Spanish. Dizzy Gillespie brought Pozo from Cuba to join his band. His rhythms with Dizzy acted like a great shot in the arm for modern jazz. Listen now as Chano Pozo with Dizzy Gillespie pays tribute to our old friend at the Bamboo Club in Havana, Manteca. Again, in a fantastic Afro-Cuban jazz recording, Cubano Bop, another example of the coming together of the parent and the child, now quite grown up, seemingly in need of direction and guidance. Chano started something when they teamed up because the influence of the new Afro-Cuban beat on the thinking of the other modern jazz musicians was tremendous. This is Stan Kenton, the most imaginative of the progressives, modernizing and sophisticating the rumba rhythms in the old familiar Peanut Vendor. in American music come and go. The big fad today is rhythm and blues. By and large, rhythm and blues is musically quite shallow, but even out of this have come a few recordings fascinating from a jazz and musicological point of view. One that is currently riding high and is most interesting is called Bo Diddley, and is sung by a blues singer named Bo Diddley. The background to his vocal is pure African in form and feeling, in rhythm and intonation. Listen to it for a few seconds and see how even rock and roll or rhythm and blues can draw upon the seemingly endless richness of our African musical heritage. Like the end of the story, because we've come to the music of today. But that couldn't be more untrue, because we are now witnessing a remarkable phenomenon. Of all of the musics of mankind throughout all of recorded time, no music until jazz could be regarded as a truly universal music. Its influence is spreading to every corner of the world, where people have radios or phonographs, and whether you are in Leopoldville or Bombay, Oslo or Buenos Aires, you will hear jazz either on records or played by local musicians. An example of the powerful effect jazz is having can be found again in Cuba. The greatest Cuban band is that of Machito and his talented arranger Chico O'Farrell. Listen to a recent composition they play entitled Afro-Cuban Suite. This is Machito and his orchestra, a Cuban band, playing their Afro-Cuban suite. But this is really a big switch, because here, for the first time, you have a Cuban band playing its own music, but using American jazzmen to execute the new direction in which it is going, a direction which seems to be headed back to Africa. Remarkably enough, the music which started in Africa, which was nurtured in the slave ports of the Caribbean and the United States, and which developed into American jazz, now seems to be on the return trip. It has returned to Cuba, and it is also headed back toward Africa via the Caribbean.
Thank you, Bill Brower, for that history of the African influence in jazz and for setting us on the road back. I'd like to have Arthur Alberts at the mic now to tell us whether the cycle back to Africa is complete.
Yes, it is partially complete, especially in the cities of Africa, but in a different way than you might expect. It includes an appreciation of jazz, but not yet a competence to perform it. The round trip of African rhythms, however, has produced the Dagomba in the Gold Coast. This is definitely in the Caribbean style, with African overtones and much that is African in origin. Call and response in three-part harmony with guitar accompaniment. Africans have been playing the guitar, by the way, for some 400 years. And this is an important urban song style in West Africa today. Thank you. African can go just so far in this modern style. In Leopoldville, I try to teach a leading Congolese band a familiar American commercial jingle. I gave them the melody on a soprano recorder, and their leader translated my French version of the verses into their more familiar Lingala dialect. 5 minutes later, they came up with their Congo version. Flashback to the style of the religious brass bands we heard earlier. Traditional African drums with the brass, but it was the most they could do. It's odd, these people cannot grasp our modern jazz rhythms. But where more traditional patterns are involved, especially in the Latin American style, the effort is more successful. Listen now to the Congo Kivu Cats, typical of contemporary urban African musical style, in a Latin American African dance interpretation, and in conscious interpretation of our own battle hymn of the Republic.
Contemporary Urban African Music by the Congo Kivu Cats. And that, as Arthur Alberts points out, brings us practically to the full cycle in our tracing of rhythmic patterns. For modernized rhythms are moving in now to play their part in influencing African music, the music that provided the original spark for the Cuban and American jazz voicings. In that move, we see further evidence of Bill Grauer's statement that jazz is the truly universal music, and in its return toward Africa, an ultimate proof of its appeal throughout the world.
You've been listening to Biography in Rhythm, a transcribed program of NBC News, produced by Joseph O. Myers, edited and narrated by Arthur Wakely, with commentary by Arthur S. Alberts and Bill Grauer. Mr. Alberts, whose field recordings of West African music were featured in the program, has more complete material in two record albums, African Coast Rhythms and New Songs of the African Coast. Mr. Grauer, an authority on jazz, is the author of the forthcoming book, A Pictorial History of Jazz, to be published in October. In coming weeks, as NBC News again resumes its popular series of biographies in sound during this time period, listen for the stories of Clarence Darrow, John Golden, and Babe Ruth, Tuesday nights on NBC Radio.
A reminder that Monitor, yes, Monitor takes you everywhere, each and every weekend, right here on NBC Radio.
Good evening. This is John Rich in the NBC newsroom in New York with 5 minutes of late news. Waves of good feeling from last week's Geneva conference are still spreading around the globe. Radio Moscow has broadcast the full text of President Eisenhower's report to the American people. France is considering establishing diplomatic relations with Communist China, and the Chinese Reds have called for consultation on Far Eastern questions in accordance with the spirit of Geneva. The Chinese Communists will have a chance to practice that Geneva spirit next Monday. Their ambassador meets an American representative in Geneva, and Secretary Dulles said today the United States will sound out the Chinese delegate on the possibility of a ceasefire in Formosa. Another aim of this second Geneva conference will be, of course, getting back the Americans still detained in China. Secretary Dulles spoke in a conciliatory manner toward Peking today. He tied only two strings to the conference. First, that this meeting will not imply diplomatic recognition of Red China. And secondly, there will be no prejudicing of the rights of America's ally, nationalist China. Secretary Dulles did not rule out a higher level meeting, perhaps one between himself and Foreign Minister of China, Zhou Enlai. He said such a meeting might be held if the Chinese show evidence of goodwill at Geneva. But for the time being, he sees no need for such a meeting. Radio Moscow's broadcast of President Eisenhower's speech is an unprecedented action. Reports from Moscow say that never before, in the memory of Westerners living there, has a speech by a Western statesman been quoted so fully. The full text was also carried by TASS, the official Soviet news agency. And in France today, Foreign Minister Antoine Pinay announced that his government will start negotiations with Communist China with a view to full diplomatic recognition. Cultural and economic questions, he said, will be discussed first. And still on a note of conciliation, the Greeks have announced that they'll sit down with the British and Turks to try to work out a peaceful settlement for the island of Cyprus. This conference will be held in London, opening August 29th. But there are still a few sour notes on the international scene. The death toll from new rioting in French Morocco yesterday has climbed to 19. Just a few hours ago, on the other side of the globe, a heavy explosion rocked the heart of the city of Saigon. One Vietnamese was wounded from the bomb, which tore a hole in the roof of the government's newly opened information center. And down in Washington, the domestic storm rages over the outside business interests of Air Force Secretary Harold Talbot. Mr. Talbot made a return appearance before Senate investigators who are studying the propriety of his maintaining partnership in an efficiency firm whose clients include defense contractors. Testimony today brought out that Attorney General Herbert Brownell had been informed of the Air Secretary's outside business interests last January. But at that time, he expressed neither approval nor disapproval. President Eisenhower is being kept fully informed on the Talbot investigation, and he'll certainly be questioned about it tomorrow at his news conference. Meanwhile, in Congress today, action was completed on a new military reserve bill.